Welcome to the Emmy Louie Show. I am Emmy Louie, and here we have today with us is Andy Kunz, and he's from the New Urbanism. And the website is www.newurbanism.org. And here on the homepage of the New Urbanism, it says creating livable, sustainable communities. And in its on the homepage, it says giving people many choices for living in sustainable, convenient, and enjoyable places, while providing solutions to global warming, climate change, and peak oil. That's a very broad topic, but that's pretty much what it is. It is a very broad topic that's affecting us all, and it's all about integrating all of these solutions together. And welcome, Andy.
Thank you very much.
Did I pronounce your last name correctly?
Yes, you did.
Okay, great. So how have things been going for you and newurbanism.org?
Well, very good. Lots of people are becoming aware of the problems and also the solutions, and I'm seeing lots of things coming together, different groups cooperating and working together, and I think we're definitely approaching a tipping point towards really enacting solutions that are really going to get to the heart of the problem. So I think it's kind of an exciting time.
It is a very exciting time, and I don't know why, but I was thinking of Barack Obama. It seems like, do you have any thoughts about the whole thing of why people are, they see hope in Barack Obama, or at least being participating in politics and all that and making a change? Do you notice anything like that? I know we didn't talk about that question, but there seems to be a resounding sense that we need to change.
Well, I think the current administration has pushed us so far in the negative direction that it's motivated people, and a lot of people are waking up that maybe were never motivated before or never cared much about politics before. That it's you know, we're down so far that it's like, okay, now everybody's ready to motivate, and I think Barack Obama has tapped into that and you know, really is capturing the emotion of the people.
And almost capturing, well, he is capturing hope. And, of course, in his books he talks about the audacity of hope. But that's kind of what we're talking about, because all of these things, we used to think that it wasn't going to affect us immediately, but somehow...
Like way in the future. I've had a conversation recently. Somebody said, "Oh, but that stuff isn't for 50 years." I go, "Wow, I think it's happening now. It's time to wake up, and now we need to do something."
Yeah, it's kind of you would think it's not happening, but then all these little things like, oh, you know, the price of gasoline, and oh, we can't eat our own fish, you know, like in the streams because they're all polluted, and you know, all of these things. Oh, you can't drink the water, and then you realize, wait a minute, you know, all of these things are creeping up, and then we realize, and then there's droughts and everything. It's like, wait a minute.
And it's all related, and if you really pay attention, it's all related, and, you know, it's all sort of converging and coming to a head all at the same time between the global warming, climate change, and now peak oil. They're both like here today, and you know, we need to address them both. It's actually, I'm even surprised how fast all this is happening. I was only a few years ago I really learned about the seriousness of these issues, and I thought, well, we have some time, but it seems like things are speeding up, so it's like we need to get in gear sooner and quicker.
Well, I think it's great that you're doing what you're doing because you're helping all of that, you know, energetically, and you are physically helping and all that, it's moving in the right direction. We're using Barack Obama because in one of his speeches he said that, you know, what we think is inevitable at one time, you know, was impossible, improbable becomes impossible, and then it becomes inevitable.
Right.
I'm sorry, I just messed that all up. But and that's what I noticed about newurbanism.org. It's one of the most comprehensive kind of views on all of the different kind of sustainable programs. It really integrates a lot of things. Do people have a hard time or easy time in digesting all of that?
Well, I think at first many people have a hard time with it. I mean, even I had a hard time with a lot of these issues, and then I started, you know, once you get past the initial shock and the reality of it all, then you start going, okay, let's settle down, sort through this, and figure out what are the steps we can take, what are the things we can do now, and what are the things we can start changing the way we plan things, infrastructure and different systems that will actually, you know, re-steer the ship, so to speak.
Yeah.
And so I try to put as much of that as I can into this website, and the more different information I find out, the more I try to integrate it in the big picture thinking, because I think the big picture thinking is probably what we lack the most and where we need the help the most. And somehow I just am able to see some of that stuff. I guess I'm lucky or whatever. You know, I'm able to synthesize things that maybe people don't really always synthesize. I read a lot and, you know, sort of try to relate things as I read. And so I think it's, I get all kind of emails from people saying, oh, wow, you know, your site is really good. It really gets into the serious issues. It really puts so many things together. And you know, that's the whole purpose, is to really, when you start connecting things, all of a sudden one solution, I mean, you know, two or three different problems start relating, and one solution solves all three of them. Whereas if you only look at them in isolation, you end up proposing a solution in isolation, which maybe creates other problems. But when you look at, you know, the bigger picture and more synthesis, you start solving multiple problems at once and actually making the bigger picture better.
That's very good. And I am, it almost sounds similar to what politicians do, and in a lot of ways you probably are. You have a certain circle of influence in regards to how politicians work. And the big picture is really important, as well as day-to-day living and how to monitor that. Like, you know, you were saying the big picture, because a lot of times when we're just, you know, during the day, where we're going shopping, we're driving and everything, we might see a certain thing, but then there's bigger trends. And at the
right.
same time, even when we're talking about, like, you know, during the day, we still get affected by all of those things day to day.
Of course. And see, this is why it's really becoming a serious issue.
It is a serious issue.
Because now it's coming down to, it's hitting people in the pocketbook right away. I mean, just driving to work all of a sudden is costing people more now
yeah.
than it did 3 months ago. And so now, you know, you add up, if you add up the rise in oil price across the board, it affects everything we do, everything we buy, because it's all dependent on oil. You know, all the shipping
mm-hmm.
of things, all the manufacturing
yeah.
of things. Oil is involved in every step of the way. So it's, you know, all of a sudden, food prices are going up.
Exactly.
Gas prices are going up.
And, you know,
up.
Andy, I was about to say, like, oh, we don't really realize the day-to-day, but now we are.
Oh, yeah, we're seeing it now, no question
because
about
we're
it.
Saying, oh,
and people
no.
are getting angry, and
we're
they're
like, oh,
you
my
know,
God,
wait
an apple costs a dollar, and, oh, stamps are going up again.
But what's funny is they
yeah.
try to find blame, and, oh, they blame the politicians, or they blame the greedy oil companies, or they blame this or that. But in reality, none of those people are, well, some of them are responsible, but the real solution is we have to design systems and redesign our systems so we're not so dependent on oil and so many steps of the process. And so, you know, you can't just attack Exxon and say it's their fault. They aren't even in control of world oil prices. They're you
mm-hmm.
know, sort of in the middle of the chain.
So
they're
in
not,
other words, we have to reset the system.
We have to reset, exactly.
Because most
exactly.
people are playing by the rules. They're doing things legally.
Right.
And
right.
You know,
so, you know, just recently the Congress called in all the oil company heads to grill them on their profits. And, you know, that's kind of just useless. It's symbolic because their profits are in line with percentages of normal company profits. It's just they're so big that it's big numbers. It's in the multiple billions. But they're not doing anything technically illegal or making exorbitant profits. They're operating, you know, some of the largest companies in the world, and so their profits are going to be big numbers, but they're not higher percentages than normal companies. So, you know, that was sort of a try to appease the population because everyone's angry. You know, who do you blame if you have a big house in the suburbs and you have a big car, and who are you going to blame when all of a sudden your monthly budget just got 10% tighter or 20% tighter? What can you do?
Well,
you still have to get to work.
You can't even blame the generation before, because it could be so many factors. I mean, it could be like our grandparents, the parents of our grandparents, our great-grandparents, but then again, they didn't know what they were doing necessarily. They only made decisions based on what they knew, and basically
right. All
of us make decisions based on what we know.
Right, exactly.
And so,
I mean, we certainly, there are some things we did wrong over the years. I mean, when we first built America, it was built in a very efficient form. Compact, walkable cities. We had a lot of streetcars and trains and all that. That was a very efficient form of living, and that's the way most of Europe is right now. But then, over the years, we started building sprawl, and we started shutting down train systems and building highways and all that, and that is our big mistake. And, you know, there's lots of players in it. I won't go into any names, but that was our mistake that actually made our whole country much less efficient and much more wasteful of oil. And now it's coming back to haunt us as oil supplies are shrinking and dwindling, and we are, you know, a typical American probably uses, I don't know, maybe 8 times more oil in a day than a typical person, say, living in France. And it's not that we're just wasteful people. It's just our lifestyle doesn't enable any other way to do it.
Well, yeah, exactly. And one of the first things you mentioned about 5 minutes ago was infrastructure. That word is a very important word,
mm-hmm.
infrastructure. And I remember in college, was it social studies, and the professor would say infrastructure, because it's the thing that it's like the backbone of the entire fabric of the places that we live.
It is, and it sets the complete tone of how everything operates.
Infrastructure. I don't even hear that word very much,
only
in certain circles.
Actually, I heard Obama talking about it. He wants to put a lot more money in infrastructure. I'm just hoping, you know, I never heard how he's defining it. I'm hoping he's not talking about building more roads. I'm hoping he's talking about building more trains.
Yeah,
infrastructure.
It's like the whole fabric. It's the big, big picture of how things connect and everything.
Oh, and, like, you know, for example, let's say our government spends, you know, $50 billion building a huge new beltway around the city. They have just set the tone for the next 20 years of car-dependent development.
And
all the developers follow, and they build the subdivisions, and the Walmarts come and all that. And then, you know, another 500,000 people are now living in that area that all dependent on cars.
You know, I just read recently that there is new federal legislation about that, about the building of freeways and trying to reapportion the money away from new freeways, because I think even our last interview you mentioned that, you know, we're still building freeways and that there's going to be new legislation to move towards, like what you were proposing about the rail.
And I think instead of, you know, lowering the percent by 5% or something, we need to just completely stop building roads. I mean, it doesn't even make any sense anymore with facing the oil situation we're facing and the global warming situation we're facing. We shouldn't invest another penny into furthering any of those systems. We should, you know, do a complete 100% switch over to trains and densifying our cities and get all these people to be able to live in places where they're not dependent on cars.
You know, that's a good point when you say about let's just stop doing this. I mean, you just made a point-blank statement. You said let's stop putting money into building new federal-funded freeways or something like that, right?
Mm-hmm.
You just said that. Now,
right.
what stops it from not? Is it because, oh, we got to file this paperwork, we got to do an impact study, or, you know, we got to shift departments? There must be all of these things that happen.
I mean, it's
and that's
a
why
huge...
things take a long time to happen, right?
Well, or I mean...
They don't take now, you know, you don't change it now. It takes maybe what time does it get phased out? It's almost like, you know, oh, let's pull out of Iraq, you know, well, you know, what time, you know?
Right. Well, no, I understand what you're saying. I mean, it's a huge, I'm trying to think of the right word. There's a whole industries and teams of lobbyists and all these people that are all locked into this mode.
Well,
and it's been that way for 50 years. So.
Why don't we think about that, and we'll take a little break, and we'll continue on about why it takes so long to kind of reverse some trends or to change our decisions about things. I am Emmy Louie. We're here with Andy Kunz from newurbanism.org, and that's www.newurbanism.org, and we'll be back. Welcome back. I'm Emmy Louie, and we're here with Andy Kunz from newurbanism.org, and we were talking about why does it take such a long time to make some infrastructural changes, or at least change the direction how things are happening. This is in specific point to about stopping the federal funding of building new freeways or new, I guess, national freeways. You want to clarify that, Andy?
Interstates, they call it also.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, what I was saying before, it's a huge industry. It's all sort of locked into play by financiers and all, you know, someone said there's like 30 or 40,000 lobbyists in Washington all just helping to keep things the way they're going. And, you know, and then there's all these environmental groups that get in there and they fight and they get another little 2% or 3%, and basically everything just keeps going on pretty much the way it is. And that's been that like that for 50, 60 years. The situation now, I think, we are really in an emergency situation. This is a national security issue. This is, you know, the future prosperity of our entire economy depends on this. This is why I think we need to just, you know, realize we're in an emergency situation and completely switch gears. And, you know, a lot of the companies, for example, the people who build roads, there's no reason why they can't switch and build rail systems. You know, there'd still be money to be made. There's still millions of jobs to be had from this. You know, and people like General Motors, there's no reason why they can't retool their assembly line.
You know, I was about to say that, retooling. Isn't that
because
a big word?
Yeah, they did it back, I think it was the Second World War. General Motors stopped building cars, and they completely retooled in about 6 months and started building all the equipment they needed to help fight the war.
Uh-huh.
And they still were making a profit. All the people kept their jobs. You know, I think we're at that situation again right now. They need to retool and start building trains and wind turbines and solar panels, you know, the products that we really need right now. And, you know, there's already a shortage of wind turbines.
And it makes me wonder, for all the things that are retooled, how many things don't get retooled or, you know, because I've seen certain things like the metric system, you know, never was ever changed. We never changed the metric. I mean, that's a really major...
I think we're the only country in the world.
Yeah. And then, like, the other things, we have easily transitioned into it without even people noticing it.
Right. I mean, it's a matter of the government can write a check. They do it all the time. You know, they're subsidizing airlines. They're subsidizing... Look at they just took... I mean, they made a $40 billion loan to, Bear Stearns or in one of the big finance companies just almost went bust, and the government stepped right in and helped lend money to purchase them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we do it all the time. We've been doing it for years. And that, you know, we're at that point right now. We need the government to go in, pay for what it takes to retool General Motors and Ford and Boeing and it probably wouldn't even be a bad idea to retool the defense contractors, because I don't think we need to just keep making bombs. It's not helping anybody. There's no reason why United Defense and some of these companies can't be making wind turbines and solar panels.
That's a really good point, because they have all of the systems to implement
all the engineers and all the factories and all the brains, and there's no reason why they all can't retool and really make what we need, because I think we really are in an emergency situation. And
all of these things, like you said earlier, about the fact that this is a national security issue, it's just the same, roads and all that.
I mean, you look at the situation we're in Iraq right now. I think that there's no one that would dispute the fact that we are there as a last-ditch attempt to try to secure oil. There's no other oil hardly anywhere else in the world that can keep our economy going than the Middle East. And, people say, well, we're there for democracy and all this other stuff. The reality is we're there for the oil, and we're using our military, we're draining our economy, all this stuff. And even if we do secure the oil, it's only at the rate we use it, it's only a matter of years before that's going to run out, and we're going to be right back in the same situation.
Yeah, so we need much more, much, much more long-term thinking.
Right, we have to retool our cities, we have to retool our transportation, and so we will have a sustainable, bright future rather than, just go down with the ship here.
Yeah, you mentioned something that we didn't talk about before, or I don't know if I saw it on your website, but you talked about the airlines.
Right.
You just mentioned it briefly. And what does New Urbanism say about airplanes?
Well, I think probably airlines are clearly the most wasteful of fuel, and in turn make the largest contribution to global warming. And look at them all. They're all struggling like crazy right now. Three more folded, last week? And, and oil is not going to go back down. I don't know if anyone thinks it is. They're living in dreamland. So it already is. If you think about a typical airplane, it might hold 100, 200, 300 people, and it probably takes 10,000 gallons of diesel fuel or jet fuel to move those people. It's extremely wasteful of fuel.
So you're saying people who make those airplanes, part of all of that should move into the rail?
Well, yeah. You look at the majority of flights that take place within the United States could be done on a train far more efficiently, 10 times more efficiently.
Well, I was thinking about this because I told you via email last week that I came back from Tokyo, and we flew via O'Hare. And, of course, I think it was even news yesterday where O'Hare, a lot of delays. And the weirdest thing about it, and this is March or April, this is April, and the flights were canceled because it was foggy. It wasn't because it was cold. It was because it was foggy. And it was unsafe to travel. And it makes me wonder, I guess, what would be the similar situation if it was foggy? Would trains still be going?
Oh, yeah, trains can keep up. They can operate in the snow, the rain, fog.
Yeah, there are many more variables when you're flying. For that, in addition to what you were saying about using a lot of gas and stuff.
Well, yeah, I heard a senator say one time that in the entire history of aviation, none of the airlines have ever made a profit, because it doesn't make financial sense. It's always had to be subsidized.
What about Southwest?
Well, they're still probably subsidized every way you can look at it. All these other things are paid for by the government, all the Transportation Security Agency, there's millions of people are all paid for by the government. They're not paid for by the airlines.
Yeah, I was thinking about the trains, a switch of subjects, because you were saying, a sort of switch of subjects, because you were saying about you said a politician said that, right?
It was a congressman.
The congressman. Now, if that is the case with this proposal about trains, would congressmen use rail too, or would they, and I was thinking about Abraham Lincoln. I remember in one of the movies I saw where when Abraham Lincoln was, they were, he was campaigning, and he would wave at the end of one of the trains.
From the train, yeah.
Yeah, from the train. And would it be something similar where if you're a VIP, you would have your own little whatever?
Of course. I mean, trains are very similar to airplanes. They have first-class cars. They have
exactly.
business cars. They have no smoking cars. They have no cell phone cars. I mean, all different variety. I heard recently the French train system is now going to run some from Paris to Nice in the evenings, and they're going to have dancing and like a bar car where, you know, singles
yeah.
can go on there and, you know, they'll be playing music. It's like you're in a club on your way to Nice for the weekend.
Yeah, the booze car or whatever.
Well, they already all have that.
Yeah,
I mean, you can get drinks. You can walk around the train.
Yeah, you can walk around and, yeah.
It's actually so much nicer than
yeah,
flying.
Yeah, meet some people. And all, whatever.
You have all kinds of leg room. You're
yeah.
not, you know, flying with your knees in your chest like on a typical plane.
Yeah, yeah. And so, because I often think about, you know, people who are very well known and they advocate certain things.
I read recently, I can't remember which movie it was. You know how the Cannes Film Festival is in the south of France? Well, there was one film that was, I guess all the people that made it were from London, and they chartered a train that went nonstop from London all the way to the south of France with the entire film crew and all the actors and everybody from that film to go to the festival. I thought that was the neatest thing ever. I mean, to charter a train.
yeah. So in other words, you can have any class of transit that you wish.
Right. And, like, the first-class car would have a waiter walking around bringing you drinks, just like a stewardess in a first-class plane.
Yeah. A little switch in subjects. When I was in Tokyo, I found out that there's a train, like, on the just regular subway, there's a woman-only train.
Really?
Like, a little, like, you know how you have a, when you have a subway, they're all little, what do you call those, individual, you know, when you, not a... Because
well, some of the trains actually
like a,
have like little rooms that you
yeah, a little
the door,
room, yeah, for
like
women only,
seats
and so
for six people or something.
Yeah, so pretty much you can make up whatever you want.
Oh, and some of the trains in Europe, I've gone on a few that were all night trains, and you actually have a bed in there, a sink
yeah,
and a
exactly.
bed. You have like a little room. You shut the door. It's tiny, but
yeah.
there were like two bunk beds and a seat and
yeah.
you know a little sink and stuff. So you
yeah.
know, and you go in there for. You ride it overnight, and you arrive in the, you sleep, and you arrive in the morning, and you get out, and you're at your destination.
Yeah, exactly. So the first, second, third class. So there's all of those things are
so
very, very much possible.
Right.
Very
the only place that trains are not really possible, where we're still probably going to need some airplanes, is
yes.
like going across large water bodies. I mean, small, narrow water bodies, they actually do. Can do a tunnel like they did between England and France.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how many miles long that is, but
mm-hmm.
there's no way you're going to do that from, you know, the United States. But they're talking about doing another tunnel like that from the south of Spain to Morocco. So once you have some of those connections, you can little by little eliminate the inefficient airlines from those areas and save them for just the ones where the trains can't operate.
That's a really good point. Very good point about all these things about the trains and how the airlines work. I'm here with Andy Kunz. This is Emmy Louie, and he's from www.newurbanism.org. We're talking about trains, and we'll be back. This is Emmy Louie with the Emmy Louie Show, and we're here with Andy Kunz from newurbanism.org. And we were talking about the trains, and not to pick on you, Andy, or myself, but I wanted to use some real-life examples. I'm actually going to Florida. I'm going to Fort Lauderdale in June, visit my in-laws, and I'm traveling by airplane.
I don't think you have a whole lot of other options.
Yeah, exactly. And I actually looked on Amtrak. I was thinking, well,
it takes like
maybe,
3 days, right?
Because I'm going from North Carolina, and so I would stop off at maybe Savannah, Georgia, and I'll get off at 5 a.m. in the morning or something like that.
And then 3-hour layover.
Yeah, something like that. And it would take, you know, so that means I couldn't do it in one on one trip. I would have to stay over in Savannah, and then, and so I was like, okay, I'm just, you know, and then of course I'm taking my daughter, so it's kind of a little more complicated. You know, if it was by myself, you know, I could kind of schlep it sort of. And then, so, and then I know, was it the end of this month you said you were going, I think, to San Francisco. I was looking it up online. And how would, ideally, you would be traveling to somewhere in San Francisco? Or how would people be traveling to this convention in San Francisco?
Well, I mean, my first choice would always be by train. But in this country, they either don't exist or the ones that do exist are so slow and so convoluted or disjointed that you have to get off, and you know there's a 3-hour delay, and I mean it's just ridiculous. We're an advanced, we're one of the leading countries in the world, and you cannot get around this country by train. I mean that's really an embarrassment, I think. So I mean I have to fly. There's no other way I can get to San Francisco. I mean I could take a car, and it'd take me 3 days or 4 days, which is a bit absurd as well. And you know who knows how much that would cost in gas.
Exactly. And so,
you know, it just angers me that we have never invested in all these years, especially, here's the real kicker. In the I think it was 1973 when we had the Arab oil embargo, and our country was cut off from oil from the Middle East. Our country went into chaos, and I think Jimmy Carter was president at the time, and he started enacting new policies and, you know, funding for solar and all these other things. And then as soon as Reagan got in, he canceled all that stuff, and then it was Bush's father, can't, you know, kept it everything back to Rhodes again. Then Clinton was in there, didn't do a whole lot, and then, you know, so here we are, we've wasted something like 35 years that, you know, that was sort of like a dress rehearsal or a wake up. That was our, you know, the first alarm that went off to say, you know, it's not good to be dependent on oil, and we didn't do anything. And in that same 35 years, France went from scratch and built a massive electric rail system. And so did, well, Japan started actually earlier than that. But.
I know. It's kind of, I was just really amazed because when I went to Tokyo, I realized there were some weird things. Of course, being Americans, really weird there because I went to the Yokohama, and I realized that, there's a lot of interactions with the United States there, and the history of Japan changed, including that in the World War II, American forces bombed most of Tokyo, and most of Tokyo was obliterated. And so after that, they rebuilt to basically have the one of the best rail system in the world.
Right.
And then I was thinking, wait a minute, what happened to us?
Germany did the same thing. They got into gear and built a huge rail
and
system.
And you know what's funny? And I told my husband this, and then he goes, so who really won World War II? Because remember, the Axis forces were Germany and Japan, and then we got the United States. Who really won World War II? Mm. You know, and I thought, you know, makes you kind of wonder, huh? Because look at their economy. Japan's economy is like second, and I know this because I just went there. And you look at Germany's economy, and you know, and all that stuff. And I was like, yeah.
And look at our economy right now. Just with the little run up in oil prices, our economy is already on the edge. Just from not even 6 months of rapid oil prices, because we're so ingrained in everything we do. Whereas in Japan, it probably doesn't affect them that much, or in France or Germany or all these other places, because all their transportation is, most of it is by other means.
Yes, and so going back to my initial question, I'm not going to let you go about this. You know, we were talking about your convention in San Francisco. Ideally, how would it be if you went to San Francisco? How would you go if it was rail? What would happen?
Well, that's probably the longest distance. That was, you know, I don't know if it's 3,000 miles, but I mean, that would be a long train for sure. But
that's 3,000 miles. Let's calculate this.
Yeah, if it went 300 miles an hour, let's
yes,
say.
Yes, that's correct.
That's 10 hours.
So it'd be like overnight flight.
Yeah,
so
you'd get
train.
A sleeper, and you would just go to sleep, and you'd wake up, and you'd be there.
Yeah, it would so be a bullet train, and so there must be a stop in between, right? Because if it was like San Francisco, you know, D.C., you know, they're somewhere.
Well, I think what we really need to do, and that's a good point you brought up, I think we really need to build a cross-country, really top-of-the-line system and then spin off from that with the regular high-speed system.
And your website, I think it was like one of, there was one connector across the United States. Was it in Denver or something, or what was it?
Well, you know, and maybe that's not super well thought out, but the idea was to have, and that could be the maglev, the really high-level, super fast train, and then it, you know, it just makes one cross-country run, and then where it stops at the other end, it branches out, other high-speed trains branch out and hit every other city and other places. So it'd be like the super highway down the middle, and then you get to the end and you know, switch to a different train and go in the, where you're going.
Yeah.
I think we're going to have to do that because I don't really see how the airlines are even going to be around in 10 years.
Well, you know what's interesting? I'm talking about this superhighway or this bullet train, and when we were in Tokyo, my husband says, well, why don't we go on the bullet train? And I said, I have no reason to go. I'm not going anywhere.
You should just ride it for fun.
Exactly. He was saying that. He goes, well, I want to ride the bullet train because, you know, Japan's known for the bullet train.
You want to see how it feels to go that fast.
There are people who love speed, you know, whatever, 300 miles an hour. So there is excitement in riding a very fast train, and so we can get that excitement up.
It's really comfortable too. I rode the one all over France just 6 months ago. I mean, it was spectacular. I went all the way from Nice all the way to London on a high-speed train. I had to switch in Paris, but it was spectacular. It was comfortable. It, you know, there were no delays. I mean, it was just a really nice.
And
nice,
you know,
way to go.
That's a really good point when you talk about delays or non-delays. A lot of these trains are so efficient. I think they're by the minute or by the second. They
tell
in
Japan,
you when it's
especially, I heard that they have the high speeds running like metros, like every 3 minutes. These are 200 and something mile hour trains that are 3 minutes apart.
Yeah.
That's really packing them into this.
Yeah, and I it's kind of interesting because of the chance or the non-chance for human error.
Well, when you go with this high, these are high-performance, high-level systems. They have all kinds of
sensors and all that, right?
The top-of-the-line signaling and all kinds of emergency backup systems. And, you know, if a train gets too close to another train, the brakes automatically start applying.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's, in fact, look at Japan. I don't think they've had a single death or a single accident in 40 years, same in France, same in Germany. I mean, Germany did have one, I think, where a truck got on the tracks or something. But in general, these are extremely safe systems. They are very high quality, top of the line tracked, top of the line trains, top of the line signaling.
So the safety is
the
is
safety
there.
Is way, oh, it's way higher than every other form of transportation put together.
Yes, and many people make decisions on safety alone.
Right. Well, I mean, you look at the American car system. It's something like 40,000 people a year are killed just in America in car accidents. And then there's like another 500,000 that are injured, you know, ended up in wheelchairs or crippled.
Well, you know,
or
there are a lot of things that people try to do. Organizations that try to do to mitigate all of that, like, you know, MAD, you know, all these organizations against drunk driving, or, you know, they might have whatever, better policing and all that. In a lot of ways, that's still kind of...
That's just icing on the cake. I think all those organizations need to join together and start pushing for trains. Right? I mean, think about it. If you got every one of those organizations together, there's like hundreds and hundreds of them that are pushing for one issue related to that, even animal rights, you know, that animals get killed on the roads. There's groups fighting for that.
Yeah.
It's amazing how many, I mean,
that's a really good point.
Unify all those people.
That's a really good point because they're addressing certain issues, but then what
one
you're
little
saying,
isolated piece.
One issue or one solution will cover all of those things. That's a really good point, Andy.
Exactly. That's what I'm all about, is trying to make people aware of that and say, wait a minute, you know, we can spend the money on one thing and it'll solve 100 problems rather than spending 100 bits of money on 100 different things that, you know, don't really contribute to the big picture.
Well, maybe, and maybe this goes back to, I'm going to make a comment here. We didn't talk about this yet, but, you know, remember I was saying that Japan has the second largest economy in the world and all that, and that, you know, the United States is pretty, I don't know, was it, they're up there too, right?
Right.
United States with the gross national product. And gross national product is a very interesting number because it includes all the screw-ups that we make, too.
Well, like, for example, in America, all the people that end up with cancer and go for cancer treatment, that's added into the GNP.
So, yeah, exactly.
You
so
know,
in other
I
words,
don't think that's a good thing.
Yeah, so in other words, yeah, we have a high gross national product. What does that mean? Is our life actually better? I could say, well, you know, I could just mess somebody up or, you know, go and get into a car accident. Well, I just increased the gross national product.
You did,
right? Because,
exactly.
Yeah, because
now you got the police, you got your car
exactly,
has to be repaired, you
exactly.
ran a hospital bill.
Exactly. So I just increased the gross national product.
I mean,
and then
it's
maybe
really
I'll,
absurd.
Yeah, maybe I'll, you know, whatever, you know, destroy a building. Well, they got to build another building, and so that increases the gross national
or
product. I just employed a whole bunch of people.
People in jail add to the gross national
exactly,
product.
Exactly.
You know,
and so this whole gross national product, yeah, what is it a measure of? And so...
It's not a measure of quality of life. See, that's
yeah,
what we
that's
really
for
need
sure.
to have is a measure of quality of life, which is based on longevity, age, you know, the average people live. It's based on...
many factors.
Oh, all kinds of things. You know,
exactly.
how much free time you have,
yeah,
how much time you spend relaxing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, all kinds of things that are not so easy to measure, actually.
Okay, so why don't we take a little break? We'll talk more about quality of life versus gross national product. I'm here with Andy Kunz from newurbanism.org, and I am Emmy Louie, and we'll be back. I am Emmy Louie, and we are here with Andy Kunz from newurbanism.org. We're talking about quality of life compared to the gross national product. And Andy, you were mentioning the different measures of quality of life and why that should be more important than our gross national product, really, in a lot of ways, or not should be more important, but how that what does that measure? Because we're always looking for something to measure, you know, metrics to measure something.
I agree. I think it does need to be, and I think it's far more important than GNP. I mean, GNP is if you're just looking at trying to compare numbers of, you know, how much money spending around a country, that's fine. But when you start analyzing it and really looking at it, you need to have like a balance sheet. On the left side are good things, and on the right side are bad things. For example, cigarette sales or, you know, rates of cancer or car accidents, all those things have to be sort of taken out. And even though they are adding to the GNP, they're subtracting from the quality of life issues. So, I know I've heard people talk about this before and that there's people that try to come up with different ways of measuring, maybe based on how much leisure time people have, rates of disease, all those kinds of things. Are much more qualitative measures of you know what's really going on in a society.
So what you're saying is that some of these things, these industries where they make money out of people's misery, basically.
Right.
Really, car accidents, right?
Right.
Insurance companies, not all, you know, I'm not talking about insurance companies in general, but they do make their money from accidents.
Right.
And so,
actually, a lot of the auto companies do too, because if a car is totaled, then you got to go buy another car. Or if it's not totaled, you still have to buy a whole bunch of parts to repair it.
Which is
so
even better, maybe.
That's
it's kind of like going to the dentist if you get a little...
More sales at the auto manufacturer.
Yeah, exactly. So if you, it's like going to the dentist. If you get a little you know, tooth worked out, it might cost more than just getting your whole tooth, you know, whole mouth replaced. But anyway, so these things, I'm talking about car accidents, let's say these companies that make money off of, you know, they add to the gross national product, but they don't necessarily, because these things happen, they don't necessarily increase the quality of life. What are these companies going to do then, if, per your proposal about, you know, our national rail system? You know, these companies that make money from creating or maintaining cars, what are they going to do?
As I was saying before, I think they all need to retool. I mean, right now, all kinds of people are paying attention and are now focusing on wind power, and yet there's a shortage of wind turbines.
Yeah.
So that would tell me immediately that whoever can jump into the business and manufacture wind turbines has a really bright future.
You know, actually, I was reading also that the most unlikely relationship between a switch to something else sometimes is not related. And I can't think of an example. It's kind of, this is a bad example, it's kind of like how Teflon was invented, where it was a scientist, he was trying to invent something else where things
right.
would stick, but it ended up being good for cooking. Right?
I actually
cooking
heard
utensils.
A lot of things were invented that way.
Yeah, exactly.
That it was like an accident, or they say, oh, look at this, we didn't think of this.
Yeah, exactly. And so a lot of times when we think about how people can retool and switch over to another industry, it's often something that you don't think would be related at all.
And I don't really see that it has to be related. I mean, if you're gonna retool a factory and you're gonna retrain the people, I don't see. You know, I mean, it's probably better if it is somewhat related, because then it's less retooling of things that you have to do.
Well, what I'm saying is that if it's less retooling, it's actually going to be another kind of business, even though it uses the same. And I can't think of a really good example right now.
Well, I mean, if you look at General Motors right now, their sales are dropping. They're probably getting close to bankruptcy. I'm guessing here, but that's from what I'm hearing is, you know, and then yet at the same time, there's a shortage of wind turbines. So it's like, hello, why don't they retool and make some of their factories or assembly lines start manufacturing wind turbines as fast as they can? And then all of a sudden, their sales will go skyrocket, and the company will be profitable again. All these people will keep their jobs, rather than if they don't do anything, they're just going to go right down, and eventually they'll be needing money, help from the government.
Yeah, maybe.
Or then they'll go to bankruptcy.
Maybe it's not that simple or something like that, because here I'm coming close to an example, because I have these appliances in my house, and I might have like a bread maker, and I might have like a beater that beats things to make cakes and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I might have like a juicer. And then I realize, really, those appliances are all the same, because they're based on something that revolves.
Quite simple, yeah.
Yeah, and so, but the outer exterior of it looks very different, or it's packaged in a way that's different. But the essential thing is the motor.
Right.
So it's really looking at it's more of an engineering thing, like what is it really similar to, and then change off.
Well, and, you know, of course, it's easy for me to say GM should retool and build wind turbines and trains. And then you have the reality is you have to deal with the unions and this and that and the other. But the real reality is they can work through all those issues. Say, guys, if you want to all keep your job, then we need to make a different product. What difference does it really make to the average guy who's working in one of their factories, whether he's putting together doors on a car or, you know, doors on a train or parts of a wind turbine? I don't think they really care in the end. It's just a matter of changing attitudes and saying, look, we're going to make this company prosperous mm-hmm. again, because we're going to produce products that we really need. I don't really think we need any more SUVs, to be honest. They keep trying to crank mm-hmm. them out, and sales are dropping every day. And the more oil goes up, the more they're going to drop.
Mm-hmm. And one thing I was thinking about where we are right now is similar to almost musical chairs. And I don't know if that's a really good analogy, where when you play musical chairs, I know it's been a long time.
Somebody gets left out if they don't move quick, right?
Well, where musical chairs where the music is playing and you're walking around, and then when the music stops, you have to find it. I mean, it's almost like we're all walking around looking for that next chair. You know, chair. And when the music, when it's time to shift, boom, we're going to go somewhere.
Right. But, you know, I think it's pretty obvious if I'm head of GM and you just keep trying to hammer out the big SUVs and no one wants them, so you spend more money on advertising or giving discounts or incentives and all this stuff, it's like, wait, you know, why wouldn't you say, okay, what do they really want? What do they really need? Let's produce that rather than keep trying to do the same thing over and over and over and figure out all the ways you can make people want them.
I'm sure people, these companies, are befuddled right now because a lot of these things are based on statistics on past purchasing.
Right, and
statistics.
They've just been doing the same thing for 40 years,
yeah,
and it's always worked, and why is it not working?
Yeah,
now?
It's like they're befuddled right now. Like, wait a minute, these trends are not, wait a minute,
right.
We can't predict things,
right.
Because, and they're, everything's blamed on this whole prime, subprime thing.
Right.
And
then it'll be blamed on the greedy oil companies. And
yeah, and so what happens is that it's basically a supply-driven economy. It's like, well, we're going to supply it, and hopefully these people will buy
yeah.
these things.
And not just hopefully, but they'll spend billions advertising to hit you over the head to get you interested
yeah.
rather than
yeah.
making what you really want.
So they're befuddled right now.
You're right. They probably
yeah.
are.
And the rest of us are befuddled, too. The consumers are befuddled.
Because I had a friend who, he's a contractor, so he needs a truck, but he wanted to go buy a hybrid truck, and so he went to a dealer, and they said, "Oh, there's not going to be any available for 3 more years." And he's like, "Why?
We got to finish our
How
end.
Stupid are you guys? I'm here now with money to buy it right now today because I want to cut my expenses on gas, and they're just not making them. And there is demand, and they're just ignoring it."
Yeah. Well, we're out of time. It was great talking to you.
You too.
We had a very very lively discussion. Well, good for you, and keep up the good work, and I'll talk to you next time, Andy, and Andy's from newurbanism.org, and there's a lot of information on there. And any plug you want to make?
No, I think let's just keep trying to get the word out there, what the real solutions are, and get moving doing them.
Well, good. Okay, okay. I'll talk to you next time.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, great.
All right,
have
bye-bye.
A good one. Bye-bye.